I've entitled the message this morning, Self-Righteous Hypocrites. And the passage, the text, comes out of Luke chapter 11. It's actually a longer text than I'm going to read this morning. I'll come back and we will pick up with verse 45 because it's the same event. Jesus has a lot to say on this particular occasion that Luke records. But I want to read just the first part of this event, verses 37 through verse 44. It says, while Jesus was speaking, and if you go back to the preceding verses, he's been talking about one day on the day of judgment, the people of Nineveh are going to rise up and condemn this generation because one greater than Jonah was here. One day on the day of judgment, the queen of the south, the queen of Sheba, is going to rise up and condemn this generation because one greater than Solomon is here. And Jesus talked about a lamp and light, and he said, the reason you don't understand and receive who I am is because you're blind. The light's shining, but you got eye problems, and you don't see it. So while he's saying all of that, so it's kind of like in the middle of what he's saying, while Jesus was speaking, a Pharisee asked him to lunch, asked him to dine with him. So he went in and reclined at table. The Pharisee was astonished to see that he did not first wash before dinner. And the Lord said to him, now you Pharisees, cleanse the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You fools, did not he who made the outside make the inside also? But give as alms those things that are within, and behold, everything is clean for you. But woe to you Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and every herb, and neglect justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. Woe to you Pharisees, for you love the best seat in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you, for you are like unmarked graves, and people walk over them without knowing it. What kind of conversations do you have around the dinner table? What kind of subjects do you discuss, perhaps at the evening meal? Dinnertime conversation is important. There have been all kinds of scholarly studies even over the years written on the subject, especially of parents having dinner with their children and talking about things about the day, the importance of dinner table conversation. There was a book that I enjoyed reading some years ago simply called Table Talk. And it's a collection of a number of things that Martin Luther said at the dinner table. In his day, he was already, everybody realized he's going to go down in history as one of the greatest Christian leaders ever. People recognized that in his day. So every evening at 5 o'clock, when that was his dinner hour, there would always be students that were at the house, there would be guests at the house, and people would kind of like surreptitiously try to write down, so what do you think about the crops this year? And he'd comment and they'd write it down on their napkin or whatever it was. And so over the years of doing that, there's some 7,100 entries that is in Table Talk where Luther comments on everything from the fashions of the day to who knows what all. It's interesting, it's fascinating, it's informative. The book that collects it all is called Table Talk. Well, thinking about this text, I thought I'm going to look up what Table Talk is in the dictionary. And so I looked it up in Webster's Dictionary. Here is how Webster's defines the phrase Table Talk. Table talk is an informal conversation at or as if at a dining table, especially the social talk of a celebrity recorded for publication. Now, I suppose then this would be table talk, wouldn't it? And so here this passage, they're gathered at the lunch table. This isn't the only time in Luke's gospel he records a dinner setting. There are 10 such events that Luke puts in his gospel, way more than all the other gospel writers, because for Luke, these dinner time settings not only carry the narrative forward, but many times around the dinner table, Jesus, the teaching moments that were there for him are very significant to who Jesus is, what he taught, what he came to do, all of that laid out in various times of table talk. And Luke records 10 of these incidents in his gospel. And so here we find a Pharisee invites Jesus over to lunch. And he accepts, and as the conversation unfolds, I read just part of it this morning, as the conversation unfolds around the meal, Jesus offends his host, and he offends virtually everybody who is there at the lunch. And the reason is clear, that wasn't accidental on his part. Because Jesus accuses the one who invited him to lunch and all of the guests who are there, he accuses them all of self-righteous hypocrisy in the strongest possible terms. And you look at that and you think, boy, that takes a lot of boldness when you're invited to somebody's house and you're around the dinner table and a meal is provided and to say, you hypocrites, you fools, all of you. But that's what Jesus did. So you look at that and you say, you know, I might not have done it that way. But you know something? The Pharisees and the scribes and the lawyers and all these religious folks, you know, from what I know from the Gospels, they had it coming. They are exactly as Jesus describes them in this passage. They were legalistic, they were arrogant, they were judgmental. And all of that is true. All of that is true. But when you think of the text in that way, it's easy to read it in a detached manner and stand back from it and say, well, that's interesting. You know, it was interesting this morning that the pastor spoke on this text because it helped me to understand first century culture a little bit more. Help me to understand a little bit more what the Pharisees were like and kind of their arrogance, and you stand at a distance looking at the text. But what's the main purpose of the text? Is it to give us historical insight and information? I don't think so. I don't think so. Let me ask you a question. What is the greatest danger that the Christian church faces? Just think of how you'd answer that question. What's the greatest danger the Christian church faces? And if this were a Bible study, I would say, like some answers. Give me some answers. What's the greatest danger? What might be some of the answers you would give? Some of you might say, well, I see the greatest danger as being the growing antagonism between the church and an increasingly secular and even anti-Christian society. I see that as being the greatest danger, with even the church beginning to compromise with culture. Okay, if you gave that answer, that'd be a good answer. Maybe some of you would say, well, what I see is the church drifting off into theological liberalism in so many directions. A denial of the authority of Scripture, a denial of the inspiration of the Bible, a denial of even the miracles and the sorts of things you read in the pages of Holy Scripture, still call themselves Christian, but they're theologically far away from what the Bible proclaims and teaches. I see that as the greatest danger. And if you gave that answer, that'd be a good answer. Maybe some of you would say, thinking about the wider church, you would say, you know, what I see as the greatest danger is the rise of militant Islam around the world. Militant Islam impacting and persecuting and killing. In fact, even if you read this little What in the World this week, you'll read about Muslim killing of Christians in various places. And so you say, that's the greatest threat, militant Islam and the impact on the church in many places around the world. If you gave that answer, that would be a good answer. Philip Ryken, who's currently president of Wheaton College, says that's not what the greatest danger is. And I want to read his words. Here's what he says. The gravest danger facing the church, the gravest danger may come from theologically informed, religiously active, morally conservative people whose hearts are far from God. Wow. I mean, is he right? Maybe he is. The greatest danger to the church is from active, participating, conservative people whose heart is far from God. That's the greatest danger. So if that's the case, then this passage this morning has direct application to you and me. Because in this room, the vast majority of us are religiously active. We volunteer for all kinds of things. We are religious and moral conservatives, most of us in this room. If that's the case, this passage is for you and me. And I don't mean by you and me Christendom at large. If you've got, you know, folks who are in some really liberal church who doesn't believe much of anything, they aren't conservative really morally, they embrace gay marriage and all kinds of things. Okay, Jesus isn't talking to those kind of folks in this passage. Jesus is addressing religiously active, moral, theological conservatives like the Pharisees and like you and like me. And so we need to hear this passage for ourselves. Because truth be told, we are cousins of the Pharisees in more ways than we want to admit. And so in this text, at this dinner gathering where Jesus upsets everybody, in the portion that I read this morning, Jesus levels four very specific criticisms at those whose lives are marked by self-righteousness and marked by hypocrisy. And if we honestly look at Jesus' words and don't leave it 2,000 years ago, yep, those Pharisees. If we honestly look at Jesus addressing conservative people, religiously active people, people who believe the Bible, if we see Jesus addressing those kinds of folks, then he's talking to us. And if we honestly assess his words, and if we have an open heart to what Jesus has to say, we'll be able to say, is there self-righteousness that marks my life? Am I marked by hypocrisy? I don't care about the folks 2,000 years ago. What about me? So that's how I want you to hear this text. That's how I want us to look at it this morning. And again, Philip Ryken in his little study puts it in the form of statements. I've revised a little bit what he has to say. But I want to use the same formula. Jesus makes four statements in this text about hypocrisy and about self-righteousness. And I want you to notice them one by one. The first one is this. The first sentence is this. I am a self-righteous hypocrite. And notice it's I, not other folks are. But I am a self-righteous hypocrite when I'm more concerned about my outward appearance than I am about the condition of my heart. Jesus says to his guests, to the guests that were there at this dinner, he says, you know, if you're hosting a dinner, and there they are sitting around the dinner table. If you're hosting a dinner, you can use dishes. What if they're sparkling clean on the outside, but when you put down the plate or the serving bowl and it's encrusted with food from who knows how long ago, what does it matter that the outside of the serving bowl is clean if the inside isn't? Jesus says. Or you think about, put it in terms of a coffee mug. I don't know if you've ever done this, but sometimes I'll have a cup of coffee and I won't finish it, and it gets a little cold, and I think I'll dump it out later, and then it sits there for several days, maybe a week or so, someplace. And then I find that coffee cup with the coffee that's been sitting in it. And it needs thorough cleaning, but suppose I don't do so. It's just like, boy, that swill in here. And I dump it out, and the outside of the cup is clean, and like Pastor Dave's over visiting. Hey, Dave, would you like some coffee? And I fill up that cup that has scum and swill and stains all over in it. Jesus says, that's what you're doing. That's the way you are spiritually. The outside of the coffee cup is clean, but there's been swill sitting in there for a week and a half. It's never been cleaned out. You got a serving bowl on the table. It's nice. It's a nice pattern of china, but the inside has crusted on food that's never been cleaned off. And Jesus says, that's the way you are. And you notice what he says. Verse 40, you fools. You fools. You ignore the fact, he says, that the God who created the outside is the same God who created the inside. And God is concerned about both. Is he concerned about our outward behavior? Yes, but it needs to flow from the reality that's on the inside, not something tacked on to make others think we're spiritual. And so Jesus says, you're a fool because you merely focus on outward appearance and you forget that God looks on the heart, 1 Samuel 16 and verse 7. And so Jesus says, so here all of you are around the table. You're criticizing me because I didn't wash my hands before dinner. And Jesus says, so all of you are around the dinner table with freshly washed hands. Good for you. That's all fine and good. But what about your unwashed hearts? That's what he's saying in this passage. No wonder they got offended. And so Jesus says, if you want to clean something, it's not your hands you better start with. If you want to clean something, start with what's most important, namely the inside, namely your heart. Because Jesus says, you notice verse 39, on the inside, the reality for you, he says to the guests at the dinner table, the reality is you're full of greed and wickedness. And you notice, he goes on in verse 41, you give alms to the poor, to those in need, because you want to appear spiritual. You want to appear, I'm just so giving. I'm just so generous. Jesus says, you're not giving, you're not generous. The alms that you give cover up what's really going on in the inside. You are filled, he says, with greed and with wickedness. You actually love your money. You actually love your possessions. You're a materialist, Jesus says. And so verse 41, he says, give as alms those things that are within, and behold, everything is clean for you. Deal with your heart condition first. And when your heart is clean, on the inside, there will be love for others. There will be a desire to give to others. There will be a real spirit of charity toward others, Jesus says. And then what's on the inside will show up on the outside because it comes from a clean heart. So, Jesus challenges you and me this morning to think about this. Am I more concerned about my outward appearance than I am about the condition of my heart? Does your inside match your outside? Let me just give you some examples. So, when you talk to other people, you speak respectfully to them, even if on the inside you hate them and can't stand them. But outwardly, it's like you're very respectful, you're very polite, very nice, but on the inside, all kinds of evil, hostile thoughts. It's a hypocrite. Your inside doesn't match your outside. Or what about when it comes to language? Oh, I never swear. I'm one of those, I don't believe in cussing. I don't take the Lord's name in vain. I don't believe you should use vulgar four-letter words. I never do that. That's your outside. But then the thoughts on the inside, all kinds of vulgar words and cursing, that's in your heart. Oh, your outward words are good and fine and pure and holy, but it doesn't match up with what's on the inside. Or what about when it comes to sexual relationships? What does the Bible teach about that? Very clearly, it's reserved for marriage between one man and one woman. All right, you say, well, that's what I hold to. I'm a religious and moral conservative after all. I'm against gay marriage. I'm, you know, all these kinds of things. Okay, so you have the outward stand that's biblical, but there's raging lust on the inside that you're never dealing with. Jesus would say, you hypocrite. You hypocrite. Or do you say when you're in the midst of a trial, you know, somebody says, how are you doing? Oh, I trust God. That's what you're supposed to say, isn't it? If you're a Christian, yeah, I'm just trusting God through this time in my life, and you know he doesn't make mistakes, and I'm trusting in Him. But on the inside, you're really angry at God. You are bitter on the inside. You are resentful. Jesus says that's hypocrisy. So the question you and I need to ask ourselves, the first part of our text, am I more concerned about my outward appearance than I am about the condition of my heart? Question or statement number two. I'm a self-righteous hypocrite when I identify true spirituality with my own little rules, man-made rules, by the way, rather than the things that actually matter to God. You notice in verse 42, Jesus mentions tithing as an example. Now, the Old Testament clearly commanded tithing. You can read about it in Deuteronomy 26. The call to give 10%, it says, of your produce, because it was an agricultural economy. And by produce, Deuteronomy meant your wheat, your grains of various kinds, your wine, your olive oil that you got out of your olive trees, your olive grove. Those things were to be given to the Lord. A tithe was to be given. And by the way, in the New Testament, we live under grace. We're not under the law of the tithe. And this is a little off the track, but I would challenge each of you as believers to make that a starting point of your giving. Not because you have to. Not because we're under the law of tithing in the Old Testament. We're not. But I want to challenge you, if that was the law of the Old Testament, if you've been changed by grace, what should your giving look like? Because you notice Jesus in this text, when he talks about even their tithing, he says, these things you ought to have done. So it's not that the tithing is wrong. You notice Jesus says in the text. But you notice what the folks had done that he's speaking of here. So Deuteronomy says, tithe of your produce, meaning the grain in your field, whatever kind it was, the produce of your vineyard and of your olive trees. And the Pharisees said, well, if that's what God asks of us, what if we went beyond that? Talk about earning favor with God, talking about chalking up extra credit. And so they said, what if we even with the garden herbs that we are growing in little pots out on the patio behind the house, what if we tithed even of our garden herbs? Boy, that would really be something that God would be pleased with. Okay, there's nothing in the Bible about tithing of your garden herbs. It's a man-made rule. If you want to do that, that's fine. But they made that the essence of spirituality. I'm really spiritual because when I look at my mint plant and I take off 10 little mint leaves, I give one to the Lord. I'm spiritual and you're not because you don't go that far. I'm a self-righteous hypocrite when I identify true spirituality with my own little rules rather than the things that really matter to God. And so these Pharisees could tithe one mint leaf out of 10. I mean, they were legendary tithers, by the way. Anybody in the ancient world says the Pharisees, when it came to tithing, they were just like unbelievable what they did. And of course, that outward appearance is, and I am much more spiritual than you are. You don't tithe of your mint plant? Why, I do. I identify true spirituality with my own little rules rather than the things that matter to God. You notice here, in all of their legalistic arithmetic, counting, you know, how many leaves off of a spice plant or a mint plant, in all of that legalistic arithmetic, they lost the joy of giving. The joy of giving generously to the Lord. The joy of giving from the heart, giving freely. Oh, they never missed a mint leaf. But what did they miss? They neglected justice and the love of God. Talk about majoring on minors. You're concerned about mint leaves, but you're not concerned about loving God and justice to others. When true spirituality is centered in all these little minute do's and don'ts and rules that we invent, and not in the things that God is concerned about, we are a hypocrite. But you think about this, justice and the love of God. Okay, what are the boundaries on that? So I'm supposed to love God. My life's supposed to be marked by justice. How do I know when I get there? I mean, like, I can count mint leaves and I can feel good because it's like, yep, 1 out of 10, good. But what about justice? What are the parameters to that? That's kind of vague. That's kind of wide open. Loving God, I mean, where does that start? Where does that end? You know, it's a lot easier to stick with the minute. It's a lot easier to stick with the measurable. Feel pretty good about my spirituality and forget about the other stuff, which I can't count and I can't measure. Those were the Pharisees. God's call to us is, we're called to love God. You notice that in the text, verse 42. We're called to embrace justice. What does that mean? If you read the Law and the Prophets in the Old Testament, justice means a number of things. It's spelled out in many passages. It means, for example, defending the weak. It means protecting the poor. It means welcoming strangers. It means ministering to widows. It means caring for orphans. That's how God defines justice, specifically, in the pages of Scripture. You recall what Micah said Micah chapter 6 in verse 8. He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? Be sure you count your mint leaves. How does the passage go? What does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? I know I am a self-righteous hypocrite when I identify true spirituality with my own little rules about who knows what, rather than the things that actually matter to God. Let's look at number 3. I am a self-righteous hypocrite when I want others to recognize and honor me for my spirituality. Because see, that's part of this whole deal. You want to outwardly be a righteous, you want to appear upstanding, better than most, and you want to get credit for it. You want others to recognize it. You want others to put you up on a pedestal. I am a self-righteous hypocrite when I want others to recognize and honor me for my spirituality. And you notice Jesus gives two examples in verse 43. He says, "Woe to you Pharisees," here's his first example, "for you love the best seat in the synagogues." What was the best seat? Well, a lot of churches still have it today. It's you'd sit on the platform. You know, you go to a lot of churches and the pastor will be on the platform and maybe one of the elders will be. Okay, if you're important enough, you get up on the platform. That's where you sit. And so the practice of Christian churches, that being so, goes all the way back to synagogue days where the important people sat on the platform looking out at everybody in the congregation. And Jesus says here in the text, you love to sit on the platform at the weekly service. Because but you being up there, it says to everybody, you're somebody. You're a leader. You're important. You're spiritual. That's the way you look at it. And Jesus says, you love to have that seat on the platform at the weekly worship service. And then you notice he gives a second example. You love the best seat in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces. Greetings, you have to understand, 2,000 years ago were not, hey, long time no see. How are you doing? Fine. Have a good day. That wasn't the way greetings were in the Near East. The greetings were oftentimes very elaborate and flowery. And the more elaborate and the more flattery, if you will, that was involved in it, the better it is. So you walk up and you say, "Ah, Rabbi Shimon, great repository of the wisdom of Solomon, teacher of the uneducated, one who sets the standard in our community for righteousness and truth, proclaimer of God's word, renowned by all, son of the blessed Eliezer, may his memory be praised, son of," I mean, the greeting would go on like that, and then what you do as the Pharisee is you would bow, oh yes, oh yes. Jesus says, you love that stuff. You love that stuff, those kind of greetings. I am a self-righteous hypocrite when I want others to recognize and honor me for my spirituality. When I was in the Rotary Club in Minot, that was interesting. Because Rotary is, if you know, there's other service clubs, Lions and Sertoma and all of those. But Rotary is, anybody who's anybody in town. So you have in Rotary, you have the mayor, you have the fire chief, you have the police chief, head of Trinity Hospital, Jim Olson from KXMC-TV. I mean, all these different, so anybody, Chet Wrighton, I mean, everybody's in Rotary. That's anybody in the Minot community. And so you come to our weekly meeting. It was just an interesting experience for me talking to all these different people that I never would have met otherwise. But Rotary urges all the members to donate $1,000 to the Paul Harris Scholarship. Paul Harris was the one who founded Rotary in Chicago, who knows how many years ago, 100 years ago, something like that. It's the huge Rotary Endowment Fund. And so we were all encouraged to give $1,000 to this endowment fund. And of course, when you did, you'd be called to the front. Usually it'd be a group of several. You'd be called to the front, and there was a little proclamation that the president of Rotary would read, about, your concern for people, and you're a great humanitarian, and, your dollars will go far, and, whatever all else was said. So you donated $1,000 to Rotary. And but once you got that special pin that you were a Paul Harris fellow, there were places in the pin for putting in sapphires and rubies, kind of like the little badge for Sparks where you get your little jewels. So if you accomplish, so if you gave another $1,000, then you got a sapphire in opening number one. You gave another $1,000, you got another sapphire. And after a while, I think it was like five sapphires, then it went to rubies. Anyway, there was a gentleman in our club who delighted to give $1,000 every so often. And of course, when you'd give that extra $1,000, he was called to the front. I mean, a big deal was made about all of this. And praised and recognized as a great philanthropist, as a great humanitarian. And we could look at him up there on the platform of our Rotary meeting and could say, you know, he's so much better than I am. He's so much more caring. He's making such a great difference in this world, far beyond anything I'm ever doing. And I remember one day sitting there for like maybe his third ruby or whatever it was. And the words of Matthew chapter 6, verse 2 suddenly came into my mind where Jesus says, truly I say to you, they've received their reward. That's all there is. I'm a self-righteous hypocrite when I want others to recognize and honor me for my spirituality. What does Jesus say in John 5, 44? Jesus says, you cannot pursue the praise of God and the praise of people at the same time. And so what is our calling? Our calling in life is not to do stuff so people will put us on a yet higher pedestal, so they'll look up to us yet even more. What is our calling in life? It's simply to carry out whatever God has given us to do as a believer, to do so with joy, to do so to His glory, to be willing to give other people credit, to take the lowest place, to do our sacrifices in secret, Matthew chapter 6, to not care what other people think, not care if they even know what I did. Doesn't matter, because I'm not answerable to them, and I'm not out to see that my reputation is even greater than it was before. I am a self-righteous hypocrite when I want others to recognize and honor me for my spirituality. And that leads to the last statement. I'm a self-righteous hypocrite when I'm so concerned about external religion and thinking here of a lot of man-made external religion like tithing mint leaves or whatever it is. I'm a self-righteous hypocrite when I'm so concerned about external religion that I spread spiritual contamination everywhere without even knowing it. Verse 44. So are you that kind of person? If you are, notice what Jesus calls you in this verse. You are like, he says, unmarked graves. That's a powerful image because in the Old Testament, in the law, in the book of Leviticus, in the book of Numbers, if you came in contact with a grave, that was spiritually defiling because death was defiling, according to the law of Moses. And so that's why graves were always clearly marked. That's why, by the way, at the Passover time of year, in Jesus' day, when thousands of pilgrims would come to Jerusalem, as Passover season was drawing to that point on the calendar, all the graves and tombs in the whole vicinity of Jerusalem would all be freshly whitewashed, so that when you came as a pilgrim, not living around there, you wouldn't inadvertently wander into a cemetery. You wouldn't inadvertently come in contact with the dead, because it would defile you and you couldn't partake of Passover. Concerned about external religion, my own little rules, and it's not just that it affects you, but it defiles and contaminates others, and you don't even know it. Back around 1900, there was an Irish immigrant who came to this country by the name of Mary Mallon. And she came to the New York City area. She had landed at Ellis Island. And she was a cook. And so she found work in the New York City area, greater New York City area, for families that were rather well-to-do. She would serve as a cook. She would be hired by them. She'd live in the house. Several families went from one to the next to the next. Well, Mary seemed like a fine choice. She was an immigrant lady. She needed a job. She seemed to have some skills. What the families didn't know was that Mary Mallon was a carrier of a pathogen associated with typhoid fever. And so as she moved from place to place, house to house, family to family, people, every place she went, became seriously ill. No one didn't make the connection at first. People in the family became seriously ill, and in several of the different families, three people ended up dying. And none of the families suspected that Mary Mallon, or Typhoid Mary, as she later came to be known, was carrying a serious and a deadly disease. Jesus is talking about that sort of thing in our text. If you embrace a scorecard kind of spirituality made up largely of your own little rules, you're like a Typhoid Mary. You're spreading spiritual contamination wherever you go without knowing it, Jesus says in this text. Because you notice, people walk over them without knowing it. And so you're very concerned that every T is properly crossed, every I is precisely dotted in your own version of what spirituality looks like. And you watch others, of course, to make sure they do the same thing too. I can remember when I was a kid growing up, we couldn't do stuff on Sundays. And I remember one Sunday, one of my friends called and said, "Hey, you want to go play golf at Hiawatha Golf Course?" Well, I should have known better. But I asked my parents, like, "Can I go golfing?" It's like, what kind of person even asks that question? This is Sunday. This is the Lord's Day. You don't golf on Sunday. You think about, a lot of us grew up with all kinds of rules about stuff. I can remember my parents debating whether we could play Old Maid or not because they're cards. And I remember arguing, saying, "Yeah, but they don't have the Jack and the Queen and the King on it." And my mom's like, "Cards are cards. You start playing Old Maid, and next thing you know, you're playing poker." And my dad thought that maybe Old Maid was okay. Okay, so there are all these kinds of rules. So if you make spiritual life, okay, if that's the center of spiritual life, you can judge somebody by the list of things you do, by the list of things you don't do. Remember that song we sang this morning, "No List of Things I Have Not Done"? Okay, some of us grew up with that kind of spirituality, that it's found in all these little externals. There's not a verse about playing Old Maid in the Old Testament or the New. You know, there's not a verse about, can you play golf on Sunday or not? Okay, if you don't want to play golf on Sunday, don't think you should. More power to you. That's your conviction. But to make it a rule for everybody else that you're not spiritual unless you observe what I think you should observe. See, this is what Jesus is talking about here in this passage. Here's what he's talking about. So, is your spirituality essentially a list of forbidden activities? Or is it a checklist of required activities? And do you assume that by checking off all the items on your list, on the "I don't do" list, and "this is what I do engage in" list, that if you can check them all off, you're spiritual? Jesus says if that's your approach to spirituality and you foist that off on others, it will not only harm you, it'll destroy everybody you touch. Because it's giving you a version of Christianity which is not Christianity at all. And so Jesus says you become spiritually toxic. You contaminate. And rather than drawing people into a closer relationship with God, you actually block knowledge of God. You actually block true spirituality. And in the end, you harm others and maybe even some that you destroy. And you don't know it. Jesus does. How different the gospel is. Did you listen to what the music that Rob picked out this morning that drew our attention to the gospel, that Jesus paid it all kinds of stuff? That was in what we sang. Because you see, the gospel is so different than man-made religion. It's so different than the religion of externals and rules and lists. The gospel changes you from the inside out. The gospel enables you to know the difference between big things like mercy and justice and loving God and loving your neighbor and counting mint leaves. The gospel enables you to see that kind of difference. The gospel enables you to see yourself as a sinner. Because once you go the route of externals, "I'm not that bad because I do this and I don't do that." When you understand the gospel, you say, "I'm a sinner. I am a sinner through and through," we sang this morning. mean, were those just words, or did you mean that? I am a sinner through and through. My only hope of righteousness is not in me, but only you. See, that's what Jesus is getting at in this passage. The gospel lets you see yourself the way that God sees you, and it sets you free from the performance treadmill that is so much a part of religion. Because what does the gospel do? The gospel grounds you in the "it is finished" of Calvary. It grounds you in Jesus paid it all. That's where it grounds you. And the gospel helps you to understand that whatever's good in my life, it's not like, yep, I've reached the bar. Yep, I measure up to the standard. And why I even go beyond it. If there's any good in your life, you recognize all of it is the grace of God, period, from A to Z. So let me ask you this morning, when it comes to this question of self-righteousness or hypocrisy, are you clean on the inside? That's where it starts. When people see you and they look at your life, do they see the real you? Or do they see what you want others to see? Do they see the real you? Are you merely religious, or are you truly Christian? There's a big difference. Do you recognize yourself as an unworthy sinner, and have you embraced God's forgiveness and God's cleansing mercies? Embrace them for yourself. I trust that you're living in the gospel and that you have embraced the righteousness of Christ for yourself, given to all who will believe, who will receive it. Let's pray together. Lord, external religion is a whole lot easier to keep track of. It's easier to count stuff. It's easier to quantify things. But loving you, loving our neighbor, doing justice, who can count that stuff? It's easier to go the other route. Lord, how easy it is in our own faith to, in a desire to please you perhaps even, that we put together all kinds of little rules, and then we expect others to follow the rules that we have invented, and we judge our own spirituality and everybody else's by these other sorts of things, and we neglect justice and mercy and love of God and truth and all of that. So, Lord, may we rest in Calvary. And, Lord, as the gospel changes us, yes, it will show up, God, in our lives then. It'll show up in the way we treat others. It'll show up in what we do with our resources, all kinds of things. It's not an either-or, God. But help what we are on the outside to be a reflection and an outflow of your grace to us on the inside. And Lord, as we think about others who may differ with us on various points, we can have our own convictions. Somebody else can have his or her own convictions. Not make all those little things being the test of everything else. So, Lord, give us a gracious spirit toward others, and give us a spirit that reflects the love of Christ in all things. We ask this for Jesus' sake. Amen.